This is Oklahoma Perspective. As strange as it may seem, when spring rolls around, some people get depressed. There is a clinical reason for this, and recently, KRMG's Russell Mills talked to Dr. Vicky Batista about the malady.
We are on with Dr. Vicky Batista, and we're talking about something that actually affects me personally because my wife kind of has problems with this. It's called seasonal affective disorder. The acronym is SAD, literally. And this is something that this time of the year, I think a lot of people struggle with. Still going to probably be cold, still going to see a lot of clouds in Oklahoma. Can you kind of explain a little bit first, Doctor, about your background in this and why we're talking today?
Sure. I am an assistant professor in health and wellness coaching at Creighton University. And before I came to Creighton, I did a lot of work specifically in Air Force bases with health and wellness. And since lots of folks travel around and change duty stations, even though I'm based in Nebraska, we dealt with a lot of folks with seasonal affective disorder. And so I got to learn a little bit about it from clients that I worked with.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about what seasonal affective disorder is. Some people call it the wintertime blues, or maybe they don't even have a name for it, don't understand why they feel the way they feel. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. So you're right, seasonal affective disorder is known by SAD. It's a type of depression that generally comes and goes with certain seasons of the year. So generally, symptoms related to SAD begin in late fall or early winter and then end with the arrival of spring and summer. And it's called a seasonal affective disorder also because it's a seasonal type of depression. So to be diagnosed, a person generally has to have two consecutive occurrences of depression during the same time of year with symptoms ending and starting at the same time.
And what are those symptoms, Doctor?
Yep. So I have an acronym for that because I'm a acronym type of person, and a lot of times it helps folks remember what to look for the signs and symptoms of SAD.
But you mentioned that you worked with the military, and they're all about the acronyms, so no surprise there.
Yes. So when I think of winter, especially in Nebraska and Oklahoma, sometimes it becomes our opponent, right? We get tired of dealing with the cold weather and the snow and the ice and the lack of daylight hours and not being able to get outside. And so it kind of becomes our foe, our enemy, the weather does. So I always say to consider the signs and symptoms of SAD, to consider what your foes are. So F stands for fatigue and low energy. So if you're just feeling like you want to sit down on the couch and maybe binge on Netflix or watch TV, you just don't have any energy. Sometimes overeating occurs, which is the O. So generally we gravitate towards carbohydrates and sugary type of things that can tend to lead to weight gain. The E stands for excessive sleeping, and this means more than normal. Sometimes you might enjoy sleeping, but it's if you just tend to want to sleep a lot more. And the S stands for social isolation, kind of like hibernating. You just want to get home and not be with anybody and get someplace where it's warm and you can relax. So again, it's fatigue, overeating, excessive sleeping, and social isolation.
All right. So, and like I said earlier, I think a lot of people might experience that and really not have recognized it as a syndrome or a disorder or something that other people suffer with. But how common is this, and how many people deal with this?
Yep, that's a great question. So according to the Mental Health America website, which is a pretty reliable source to check out, about 5% of the U.S. population experiences seasonal depression. And like you mentioned, your wife might have some of these signs and symptoms. Generally, more women tend to present with seasonal affective disorder than men. So about 4 out of 5 people are women that present with seasonal affective disorder.
Okay, so if I got that right, and sometimes I hear numbers wrong, I think I'm mentally dyslexic. Is that a thing? Anyway, no, I'm kidding. So you said but roughly 5% of the population?
Yep.
Out of 5 of whom are women?
Yep, correct.
So I'm not a great math guy, but that would tell me roughly 8% of women?
Possibly I'm not a great math either.
All right, we're going to just skip right over that part. But it's a lot of folks. And so the obvious follow-up question to what are the symptoms are, well, gosh, doctor, what can we do about it? How do we fix it?
So there's research, especially that came out from the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, that found that consistent exercise is a great way to offset some of the seasonal affective symptoms that we have. And if we can start a exercise program earlier in the fall, so it gets consistent with our routine before, you know, winter hits, that's the best case scenario. But if you're already feeling some of these symptoms of fatigue, overeating, excessive sleeping, or not wanting to be around folks, it's still not too late to find an exercise program to help with that. Also, spending time outside as you are able and it's safe. Even a little bit of sunshine can go a long way. So, you know, taking a walk around the block or at the park if the sun is out and it's safe to be outside. Also, hobbies are a great thing to try and get going in the winter months. Having something to look forward to is a great thing to help with the wintertime blues. And then also, if you're able to schedule a vacation and to a warmer climate, that's a great thing. There's lots of research, too, that goes around planning vacations can make you feel happier. So if you're planning a vacation to a warm area, that can help with your mental health as well. And then if those things aren't working, it's always important to reach out to your healthcare provider to let them know what you're experiencing, to see if there's something that they can do to help you as well.
So are there, is this in any way associated with like our circadian rhythms, or, I mean, are there physiological effects, I guess is what I'm...
You know what, that's a really great question. Experts in this field are not exactly certain what causes SAD. Some believe that seasonal changes disrupt our 24-hour clock that regulates our functions during sleeping and waking hours. The other team believes that the changing seasons disrupt our hormones that help us sleep and regulate our mood and overall sense of well-being. So there's two different thought processes about why people are affected by seasonal affective disorder. So more to come, hopefully, on that.
Yeah. How long have they been researching this? How long has this been a thing? Do you know?
I do not know that. I mean, it's been around for quite a while.
Yeah, I remember hearing about it years and years ago, but it never really, I don't know, fired up people's imagination or something. I think a lot of people still don't know about it or misunderstand it, which is why I'm super tickled to have this opportunity to talk with you about it and, you know, get the latest.
I've been in the field for about 20 years now, and I feel that it's something that has been a topic of conversation since I've been in the field. But after my time working at the Air Force Base, it became something more that I was aware of as a health and wellness professional, just because of the target population that I was working with of active duty, changing duty stations more frequently.
All right. So is this something that can ever goes away? Does it come and go? Do some people develop it later in life, or is it a lifelong thing? What do we know about that?
Yep, that's another great question. So there is research out there saying that younger adults tend to have a higher risk of seasonal affective disorder. There was a study published in the American Family Physician that said the average age of onset is 23, but it's commonly diagnosed between the ages of 20 and 30 years old.
Do they age out of it later in life?
Well, it shows that the good news is that the risk of seasonal affective disorder tends to decrease with age. And so I'm not sure if that's because folks learn strategies to help them through those winter months, or it's just something that they learn to deal with a little bit better.
Or maybe if there is something hormonal involved, it has to do with, you know, simply the changing biochemistry that we experience later in life. So lots of research yet to be done. Is somebody doing that research besides you there in at Creighton? I mean, is there someone? I presume there's a lot of folks working on
this. This isn't a research topic of mine. It's just something that tends to come up working in the field of health and wellness around winter time. And like I mentioned, I do have some experience from my past position working with Air Force. But there are lots of folks around the United States doing research on this, yes. So hopefully there will be more solid information about why this affects some people more than others. It is interesting, though, that folks that live farther away from the equator tend to have higher issues with seasonal affective disorder than those that are living close to the equator. So, for instance, somebody living in Florida is going to have less of a chance to be affected by seasonal affective disorder than someone that's in Alaska.
Dr. Vicky Batista. The state of Oklahoma is currently in the middle of a lawsuit aimed at opioid manufacturers. Recently, KRMG's Russell Mills talked with Mike Hunter, Oklahoma's Attorney General, about the case.
I do know that you have the first major state lawsuit against the opioid manufacturers that's going to go to court. But apparently there's been some changes. Can you kind of explain, so even a fool like myself can understand exactly what you did today?
Well, sure. So in any trial, as you develop your case, I mean, you've got your initial causes of action, and then you engage in depositions and discovery. You know, you determine what your best causes of action are going into trial. And our decision was that our central cause of action has always been a public nuisance. We believe that envelops all of the other claims that we'd raised against the defendants. And what a public nuisance cause of action allows the state through the attorney general and the judge in this case is really to provide the broadest, most comprehensive remedies that are possible, both in terms of damages as well as enjoining the conduct of the defendants. So one of the benefits of this, Russell, is that we're able to avoid a lot of the pretrial static that we're having to deal with these defendants wanting to go to court every day, complaining about this schedule and that schedule. So the reason that we avoid that is because a public nuisance lawsuit, when it's exclusively based on public nuisance, that trial is a bench trial, which means the judge is the trier of fact. You don't try the case to a jury. So we're going to avoid a lot of this pretrial delay and distraction, which was taking time away from us preparing for trial. And we're also able to put our best possible claim before the judge and focus on that. And again, this doesn't diminish what we believe the state's claim for damages is. I can't be specific about it because we're still subject to discovery confidentiality going into the trial, but I'm confident that the case that we're going to put on May 28th is going to show that the state's citizens' damages are in the billions of dollars.
Okay, so the other claims included violation of the Medicaid False Claims Act, violation of the Medicaid Program Integrity Act, fraud, deceit, and those would have required a jury. And
that's correct.
Perhaps more pretrial shenanigans before we could actually go to court. Is that kind of what
you
said?
Yeah, and that was the focus. They were trying to limit evidence. They were trying to limit testimony with regard to those causes of action and those claims. And so that takes those arguments away from them. It allows us to focus on the trial and our best cause of action. Again, the goal here is to be as confident and decisive and as consequential as we can possibly be with regard to the evidence that we're going to produce in this trial to hold these defendants accountable for what they've done. Now, we didn't dismiss those causes of action with prejudice. That's the term, which means you can't bring those back. We're still looking at more expansive approaches to this trial that would include distributors or, to the state's options for further actions that would include distributors. So we haven't walked away from anything permanently. What we've done is we've narrowed the issues going into this trial. We've cut off what we believe is distraction and delay from the defendants. We're going to put this trial on before the judge, and we are very confident in our evidence, Russell.
And does the judge have any say in this, or is this simply a prosecutorial decision as to which actions you want to pursue?
So we believe that that both statutory and case law establishes that when your only claim is public nuisance, that's a bench trial, that the judge is the trier of fact. The judge has allowed the defendants, I think, until Tuesday to respond, but we're confident in our position. I mean, we believe the judge is going to agree that this is now a bench trial and that he'll conduct it.
So I read a statement from counsel for Janssen Pharmaceuticals and Johnson & Johnson. They said, Quote, we're pleased the Attorney General dismissed most of the claims, which underscores their lack of merit, end quote. I mean, I could go on with the quote, but you kind of get the gist of it right there. But you're saying that's not the case. This wasn't
well,
because you
say,
don't have...
Well, you know, they're going to say what they want to say. They, you'll note that they left out the fact that I did not dismiss those claims with prejudice. Those claims still exist and can be advanced by the state. My response would be I'll see you in court.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the settlement that has been reached with Purdue Pharmaceuticals. That was late last month. And I guess we actually got a check today?
We have received funding for the first tranche of those monies. And so that's good news. One of the concerns that we've had all through this case is that Purdue would declare bankruptcy before trial. And the result of that, as most of your listeners will conclude, is that we would have gotten zero from this defendant. So the delicate exercise was, you know, could we settle with Purdue and avoid them filing bankruptcy before trial? I mean, if they filed before trial, that would have resulted in the trial being stayed, probably with regard to all the defendants. So this was a very, very complicated negotiation. Ultimately, Purdue's condition was, show us a way to settle with the state, but make the state, the settlement with the state, have national importance. And so we just happen to have the really remarkable program at Oklahoma State Tulsa, Wellness and Recovery Program, that has already carved out national prominence for itself. In just 2 years, they've received, I think, almost $5 million in grants. Casey Shrum is a great leader there, and having a national center in the state that will be the leader in addiction science and research, that is a big deal. Because if we're going to start working on and being focused on getting Oklahomans who are addicted well and back on the straight and narrow, we need to know that we're using the best science and the best recovery programs and rehabilitation programs and programs that really work. So that's an important niche that they can fill. I think that it's a great opportunity for Oklahoma to be number one in something that will be as significant as this, not only for the state, but for the country.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, it's A, prevents Purdue from filing bankruptcy, which could throw the entire case into the, well, it could
exactly stop
everything rolling. And B, it puts money into a program here in Oklahoma and specifically in Tulsa that may actually help people around the country, even around the world, deal with opioid addiction. So kind of a win-win is how you're seeing it.
Yeah. I mean, the truth is there is really no program at a public university that has made the commitment that the OSU Health Sciences Center has made to addiction science. So addressing that, making that case to Purdue and having them do their due diligence and agree that the footprint at OSU Tulsa, really has national prominence, that was key to this settlement because Purdue did not want this settlement to be a precedent for every other state. They wanted to be able to say, look, yeah, we settled with Oklahoma, but we settled and created a national center for addiction science. So it was, you know, the negotiations were tense, and they went on for multiple weeks. But they were folks need to know that they were mediated by former federal judge Lane Phillips, and the settlement and consent decree were reviewed by District Judge Balkman in Cleveland County. So there were plenty of eyes on this thing.
Oklahoma Attorney General Mike Hunter. Special thanks to KRNG's Russell Mills for the interviews. This is Oklahoma Perspective for Cox Media Group. I'm Bert Williams.